You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 522. Human sacrifices, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria. Bill Murray, Dr. Peter Venkman, Ghostbusters.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle's Filmmaker Process. We provide filmmakers with professional services to get their films or series funded, finished, and distributed. Some of the services we offer are pitch deck creation, film budgets and schedules, domestic and international sales estimates, legal contract templates, consulting, post-production services, script coverage, professional trailer editing, poster design, film deliverables, and production payroll. To learn more, go to www.filmmakerprocess.com. Welcome, guys, to a ghost-busting episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. We have on the show today the co-writer of the new Ghostbusters movie, Ghostbusters Afterlife, Gil Kanan. And Gil co-wrote it with Jason Reitman, and I've had a chance to watch Ghostbusters, and I got to tell you, all I can tell you is no spoilers, and this episode, by the way, will have no spoilers, so you can listen to it without any worries, but all I can tell you is it is the sequel that Ghostbusters deserves. That's all I'm going to say about the film. But Gil and I not only get into the making of Ghostbusters, how he and Jason got together to write the script and all that, but also we go down the road of his career as a writer-director and what he's done with films like City of Amber, Poltergeist, and his new film for Netflix, A Boy Called Christmas. So sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Gil Kanan. I'd like to welcome the show, Gil Kanan. How you doing, Gil?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Thank you so much for being on the show, man. I'm a fan of your work. From Monster House to City of Amber, and your latest collaboration with Mr. Reitman, both Mr. Reitmans, Ghostbusters Afterlife, which we will definitely be getting into later in the conversation. But first, how did you get started in the business?
Well, I had one of those experiences that you think about sometimes when you're going to film school as a sort of scenario that might happen, but that you accept at some point during school isn't going to happen to you, which is that I made a short film that was screened at the DGA. And out of that screening, I got representation. And that the representation ended up being pretty serious. So I got signed to CAA while I was sort of graduating from UCLA film school. And the weird thing is that I had made a short film, this short called The Lark, that by any measure should not have had a commercial breakthrough potential. It's a weird 10-minute black and white live action animation hybrid about an abusive relationship with a bird.
So money, you could smell the money. You could smell it.
Nothing says box office like a clay animated tiny bird that comes to life and murders an abusive husband. It says, give this kid a shot. And so that film screened at the DGA as part of the UCLA Spotlight Awards. And there was an assistant on the desk of a film lit agent at CAA who was there covering the event. He came afterwards and gave me his card. And he then took a DVD. He might have gone with a hybrid strategy of DVD and VHS, because this was in the the final days of VHS short distribution. And he brought it into the agency and made a bunch of copies, was very intrepid with it, sent it to everyone. And by the following Wednesday, I was represented by some pretty serious people. And so that's kind of how I got my start as a film director, because they ended up sending the film around to a bunch of people. And one of those people was Robert Zemeckis, who was beginning to think about producing Monster House. And then he and I had a series of meetings that led to me being brought on to make that film. But I will say that before any of that, I grew up in the Valley in Reseda, outside of the center of filmmaking, which is sort of Burbank and Hollywood, but still sort of tangentially connected to it. Mm-hmm. And I ended up getting through a summer internship program called Inner City Filmmakers, a series of internships from the time that I was 17, just right after I graduated high school, in various departments on film, mostly editorial. And so my very first paying job, where I had to actually report to work, was as a editorial intern on the Tony Scott film Crimson Tide. And so that was a pretty crazy initiation to the world of filmmaking, and then ended up working on films throughout my university and film school careers.
I got to ask you, what is it like watching Tony Scott work? Did you get to see him like director or being on set a little bit?
So that was actually a pretty weird experience, because it was a very caustic environment, the editing room. It was actually pretty harsh. I ended up being basically a human mule carrying prints from the Disney lab to the Culver Studios, where the temporary editing rooms were set up. But I remember feeling the seriousness of it, that everyone was like taking the task of telling the story extremely seriously. Like, there was a lot of sort of octane and machismo in the air.
I don't understand why. Yeah. I have no understanding why.
And there was like literal cigar chomping going on. There may have been some cowboy hats. It was a hardcore environment, but it definitely felt like a threshold. Anyway, I got hooked from that moment on to the allure of storytelling on a grand scale, a couple hundred friends coming together to tell a story, it sort of never waned.
Yeah, it's what I like to call the sweet disease. Once you get bit by the drug, by the bug, you can't get rid. You're done. It's for life. You can't get rid of it. As much as you might want to sometimes in your journeys, you're unfortunately stuck with it. Now, I also got to ask you, because not many of us are going to have the opportunity of having a meeting, especially that first meeting with Robert Zemeckis out of college. Dude, what is that like walking into that room and just sitting down and you're like, hey, Bob?
it's pretty intense. I mean, there's two ways to answer it. The film fan in me is freaking out, obviously, right? Sure. Because filmmakers, film directors, to people like us who grow up eating, drinking, sleeping film, it's the storyteller that is the real star of every film. You know, the actors are cool, but the people who are making the film are the ones that I actually had, you know, if I could have had trading cards, it would have been Robert Zemeckis, Steven Spielberg,
Coppola's
Donner. Yeah. So that part of me is freaking out and doing backflips and like terrified and shaking, but it's sort of offset by another part of me that I discovered actually in that meeting or in the hours leading up to that meeting, which is the part of me that had a story to tell and became so passionate about making sure that I was the person who told that story that somehow I am able to suppress the terror of meeting a god and actually look him in the eye and say, I know how this story should be told, or I have some ideas for this story. And being taken seriously, maybe not totally seriously in the first meeting, but progressively with more seriousness. And I actually kind of found that out about myself at that point. And I have had that experience a few times since where I'm like, I should be objectively like freaking out. I should be vomiting in a trash can in the hallway right now.
Right.
But I feel a responsibility to the story that I don't want to let the story down. And I feel like I have, if I'm not the voice for this story right now, I don't know who else is going to do it. And they might care as much as I do. So anyway, it's a little earnest, but it's the damn truth.
Yeah. And it's also just like, yeah, because I imagine you still have to act as a professional because you want to get the job. But at the same time, the 10-year-old inside of you, you're like, oh my God, Back to the Future. Oh my God, oh my God, Roger Rabbit. Oh my God, like you're just freaking out. So I can only imagine that there's that.
Yeah. I may have mentioned in one of those first meetings that I did create a linear graphed out version of the space-time continuum across the three Back to the Future films.
Of course,
to try to find holes in the narrative structure as a kid. And
what did he say to that?
I think he's probably heard every version of
that
movie changed my life. Because for so many of us, it was a gateway moment where
so many
engines were firing in unison at the same time with those films that it just felt like we were we're the Back to the Future generation.
Yeah, exactly. There, and it's. I showed Back to the Future to my wife a few years ago, and I just hadn't seen it in forever, and I was just sitting there smiling the entire time, and she's like, "You really like these movies?" I go, "Yeah, I do. These are amazing. It's probably one of the best trilogies of all time. Like it is, it's perfection." And God help anybody who wants to remake it. I'm just throwing that out there into the universe. God help anyone who tries to remake that, because you can't.
I don't. I mean, the weird thing is, like, what would it be? It would take place in the 90s at this point.
It's just like it's kind of like the remake of Point Break. Really? Like, you can't capture that magic again.
You know, more power to them. Let's see what they do. But yeah, I don't need to see that. Maybe I've got a perfect there's a perfect place on my mantle for the films that Bob made.
Yes, absolutely. No question.
So casual.
Bob. Hey, Bob. So, you know, you worked with not only Bob, but you also worked with Steven Spielberg on Monster House. What was the biggest... What was the...
my professional lighting setup is crumbling. I'm sure everyone at home is imagining an ace Hollywood setup with a full crew behind my laptop, but... In fact, it's a desk lamp that is held up by a glass full of acorns. I'm not kidding.
This is the reality. We always like to dismiss the myths of Hollywood, and they think that like you run around with a crew walking behind you at all times.
Let me get the gaffer to adjust the mug full of acorns real quick, just so I can properly be illuminated.
Jesus.
I have a squirrel behind the laptop who's making minor adjustments right now.
So you worked with Bob, but you also worked with Steven Spielberg on Monster House. What was the biggest lesson you took away from working with those two legends?
Well, it's hard to even figure out how to approach the subject of that, because there were a few things. One, I was immediately struck by my tremendous luck at being a person was able to be in that environment, because nothing in my life up until that point suggested that that was possible. So luck definitely had something to do with it. I had an extraordinary experience on Monster House, where the very first time that I met Steven, it was with Bob, and we were showing the work that I had been doing for a couple of months to start to create the look and sort of design of the film that I would be making, or hoped to be making. And then we went into the next room, which was the Amblin screening room, and projected the animatic that I had put together with a very crack, small team of artists. And sitting down was probably one of the scariest moments of my life, like as the lights dimmed and the animatic started, I was like, okay, I guess I'm putting this out there in front of these two literal gods of storytelling. But when the lights came up, a conversation started, and within a few sentences, I realized that we weren't talking anymore about whether or not I would be making the film. We were starting to talk about the content of it, like the pacing and tone and a couple of specific plot points. And 45 minutes passed, and it was just the three of us having this conversation. I remember just thinking in the back of my head, like, I'm trying to stay cool and engaged, but I'm also thinking, holy shit, like, this is actually happening. I'm having a story conversation with these two, you know, legends. Wizards of film. I learned an incredible amount of stuff. I mean, one of the things that I've taken from that very first conversation was, because we were talking about structure and pacing, and specifically first act, and there's always a tendency, first acts are really easy to write, and then you get to go put a film together and you start to pull away because you're like, okay, you want the audience to be able to get into the real nuts and bolts of the story. And I remember coming out of that conversation, both of them impressed on me that tendency, the instinct to cut into the first act, is one that you have to suppress as a director. That you should actually fight to keep those moments that feel like they are too long, feel like they don't have any place in a film. Because if an audience ends up loving your film at the end, it's because of the investment that they put into character in the first act. And so that that's felt great. Like, okay, that's an actual lesson. You know, I took it, and I never let go.
Wow, man. That's actually a really great piece of advice. That's a really great reason of advice.
I'm happy to pay it forward.
Now, another film you did, which I was a big fan of when it came out, when I watched The City of Ember,
You're the fan.
I'm the one. It was a pleasure. I actually really enjoyed it when it came out, and I saw it, and I was like, this is really ingenious and so funny. You're the dude. Hey. But how did you?
I knew I'd meet him eventually.
Okay, but all joking aside, how did you come up with the concept of it and go down that road? And how did you get that made? That's another question.
Yeah, it definitely was a moment in time. I mean, I started developing City of Ember actually at the same time that I was beginning to have my meetings on Monster House. So City of Ember was adapted on a novel, a series of novels by Jean Dupree, who and those books were sent to me by Playtone, Tom Hanks's production company. Yeah. Again, as part of that initial round of
sure,
meeting.
Why not?
Very casual moment in my life. Totally
normal. Totally normal. Peaceful. Completely normal.
Yeah. But so I ended up developing that and was lucky enough to bring on a screenwriter who I really loved, Caroline Thompson, who had written Edward Scissorhands and countless other incredible screenplays. And she and I began a collaboration that was going on throughout posts on Monster House. So I was lucky enough to have a script that I could say, this is what I want to make next, before Monster House was even out. And I think the answer to the question of like how it got made was probably the sort of the excitement that was starting to happen around the release of Monster House. And then what sealed the deal was when Monster House got nominated for an Oscar.
Right.
Basically, City of Ember got greenlit. It was a weird moment, though, because it was like being made by a sort of experimental studio. It was a partnership between Fox and Walden that actually didn't survive the release of the film. So they were they went out of business or broke apart as a studio before we came out. And that wasn't great for the film or for me. It was a bit of a nightmare because I ended up not dealing with executives by the end. I was dealing with lawyers who were
managing. Always fun.
It's great. It's why you go into the business. You know, you want to tell stories.
And you want to talk to lawyers about assets.
Yeah, exactly. So it just felt like pure creativity. But so that it was like, it was an incredible experience. I had the best cast. I met Toby Jones, who I continue to work with. Bill Murray, who obviously I've now been lucky enough to have worked with in some capacity twice. Saoirse Ronan,
Tim Robbins.
An incredible group of actors and artists. So it was a wonderful experience that was tinged with a lot of complexity. And what came out, I'm proud of, but could have been so much more. And so it was a big lesson. And for those of you who are listening, who are thinking, screw this guy and his easy path to getting a directing career from film school, this is the moment in the conversation where you sit back and smile and enjoy some schadenfreude that I had a really hard time on the second film.
Well, there's that, and that's the thing that look, man, I've talked to hundreds, if not thousands, of filmmakers now over the course of what I do, and I've heard every story. And there's never one that's the same. You're like, oh, I just happened to run into Spielberg at a coffee shop and he greenlit my movie. Like, you hear the weirdest stories. And I've heard the easy ones. I've heard the hard ones. I've heard the ones that are completely lucky. I've heard the ones that have taken 20 years. It's all relative. But I don't care who you are, you always have, there's always those pits and fall, you know, the valleys. And, there's always that. There's always that. So regardless of how you get in, man, hey, for me, it's like, more power to you, man. If you got in, that's just, hopefully that gives us a chance, somebody else a chance at one point or another to get that opportunity. But it was timing, though. And that's the thing I always tell people, because they always, a lot of people look back to the 90s, especially during the Sundance independent phase with Robert and Rick Linkletter and Burns and Smith and all these kind of guys. And they're like, oh, I'm going to do what they did. I'm like, you can't. Like, that was a moment in time. Yeah. That was very specific. So you happened to get Monster, which is against all odds,
Monster House
off. Then it happened to get nominated. And you also had City of Amber waiting in the wings. So you didn't like start it after you got nominated. So it all, the timing was perfect. And of course, the way Hollywood works is like, oh, you just got nominated. What do you want to do next? And that's your golden, that's your Willy Wonka ticket.
Yeah, and then exactly. So it sort of was a really good set of timings and circumstances. And it was a crazy experience. You know, I'd gone from making an animated film to now having an entire city built in Northern Ireland in Belfast.
Well, I have to ask you, because, I mean, I remember the sets were stunning. And it wasn't, it was 2007, 2008, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, 2008. Yeah. 2008 was a release. 2007 we filmed.
So you filmed in 2007. So yeah, there's visual effects and yeah, there's still, you know, but it's not where we are now as far as like world building. Like a lot of the stuff, if you would reshoot that movie today, would probably be done digitally.
But wait till you see A Boy Called Christmas.
I can't wait to see that.
Actually,
that was all built?
I built so much of that city. So I had an incredible production designer, Gary Williamson, on A Boy Called Christmas. And I learned a lesson on City of Ember that when you can swing it, building the world makes an incredible difference, both for the audience, but more importantly for the actors and the cameras when you're shooting, because you just have that sense of place that's very difficult to fake when everything's green screened and cropped in. And I still fight for as much build as possible. For me, that's a priority in filmmaking. So I put real emphasis on in the budgeting phase towards getting as much tangibly built on
practical
set as
stuff. And then, so when you walked on the City of Ember, like as a filmmaker, man, what is that like playing in such a beautiful playground? I mean, you've got Bill Murray, you've got Tim Robbins, you got this insanity of a set. What is that like? You know, how did you feel being on set like day one? And also, and again, this is not an animated movie anymore. Now you're on a live action.
Yeah.
Playing with serious hitters, serious punchers.
There was a lot of stress about getting what I needed on camera in that film, because the amount of visual material was so overwhelming that I had to stay very disciplined about what I was shooting so that I could make sure that I was emphasizing performance and storytelling and not getting lost in the sort of beauty of the environment, because my eyes were bugging out every direction I looked because it was so cool. And I think that a part of me clicks into place, which is like, focus on character, focus on story. That's what ultimately is going to communicate to an audience. But it was so fun to shoot in.
And the camera, I can imagine.
It was designed to be filmed. So, you know, we were just able to move the camera through it in such a cool, dynamic way. And I love moving the camera. And it was like a real joy to be able to have all those practical lights creating material for the eye. And we shot on film, too, which is another thing that I really fought for on that one. It was like one of the last 35 millimeter films before the full conversion to digital. Obviously now there are films that fight for shooting on film again, but it really was one of the last in that series of the pure 35 millimeter from the ground up shows.
Yeah, no question. And in 2007, I mean, Red had just basically come out, and it wasn't there just yet, digital. I mean, there was some.
Collateral. Had already been out, and so we sort of knew where
the Viper.
Exactly.
But it was still like you had to work with that giant monster of a freaking rig, and it was just like it was like shooting on Attack of the Clones or something like that. It's the beginning of. It's like the olden days of 35. You saw those giant blimps that they used to work on. Yeah. It's equivalent to the exact same thing. Now, as film directors, we always have a day on set where we feel that the entire world is going to come crashing around us. Everything is going wrong. Bad performance. Actors not working. We're losing the sunlight. The first AD is killing you because you're not making your day. Something happens in that moment, in that day. What was that day for you on City of Ember, and how did you overcome it?
Oh my God, this is so long ago.
Any movie, by the way, any movie on Poltergeist, anything.
It's a really good question. I mean, there was one injury that really frightened me on City of Ember, but it wasn't, you know, it didn't end up being something that was catastrophic, but the Steadicam operator had a slip during a very complex tracking shot. And that was really difficult moment as a director,
sure,
because I felt so responsible. You know, I had designed a complicated shot that the look required a spray down, a hose down of the streets,
of course it did,
treacherous conditions, so that was really difficult. One thing on Ember that I remember that was just like a reality of filming in Northern Ireland, and I just didn't know how to expect it. We only had one day scheduled of exterior shooting, which those of you who have seen that film can understand why, but the entirety of the film was in a soundstage in this city set, which ended up being Game of Thrones, by the way. I think the entirety of Game of Thrones, all the interiors were all shot in the footprint of the City of Ember set. which is always funny for me to think about. I was like, I know just how cold that crew was on that day. But so it ended up raining every single day that we shot on City of Ember. There was not one day without rain. It was like just a crazy summer with no break in weather. And then we kept trying to get this one day of the exterior and having to miss it. It's not that dramatic or interesting, except for the fact that there was just one shot at it. And to do it, we had to take the entire crew, including Saoirse and Harry Treadaway, up to a mountain to film.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And we finally got the one break and just squeaked it out because we were supposed to wrap and finish the shooting. In a pinch, that's the closest I can remember to like a real practical challenge. The harder ones were all what came later on, you know, like
sure.
the
studio
getting, and that's a much more complex, nuanced conversation. But I guess suffice it to say, I'm proud of the finished film, and especially because of the performances of it. And Saoirse's second performance, and she's already a superstar in it. I'm psyched that you're a fan.
I am definitely a fan of it, man. I'm glad, and I'm just glad movies like that, because can you imagine trying to get that thing to made today? Like, it'd be, unless it's a Netflix film. Streamers would do it.
You'll see when you see A Boy Called Christmas, you'll see that somehow I've been able to squeak out another film that sort of goes against the grain. It has that more original element to it. It's not based on another film.
IP.
Not based on IP. And it allowed me to build out a full world that's the kind of stuff that's really, as you say, super hard to do nowadays. Extraordinarily proud of the world building in A Boy Called Christmas.
Now, you also tackled another film called Poltergeist, which in God's green earth do you approach a classic? Like remaking a classic, and then Steven. So Steven was obviously heavily involved with the making of Poltergeist. It was, Toby Hooper directed it, but Steven was there as well. You know, you see him all, you see the behind the scenes of him, like, you know, pointing, and nobody will ever know what actually happened behind the scenes of like what happened there. But regardless, the movie's a classic. How do you as a filmmaker go, all right, I think I can bring this to the new generation? And how do you approach that, man? I'm fascinated.
Well, there's a few things. First of all, you know, it's definitely about as difficult of an attempt to make as you can do, because the chances of connecting with an audience when you're entering hallowed ground like that are pretty slim. There's a few ways that process started. They gave me a sense that I should try this. One was that I got a call from Sam Raimi. And
well, that's always a good sign.
I basically should just stop there because
done. Sam Raimi called you. Done.
And so that was like sort of the beginning and the end of it for me. But also after that, I went out and found Toby Hooper, and I went up to him and introduced myself and said that I'm thinking about going into this world of film that he created, and if he had any advice, and he was so gracious, and he was
That's
just
awesome.
Like, you know, it's just a story. Like,
it's just a movie, man. It's all good.
I've sort of gotten that kind of feeling from folks who have made things that are so meaningful to me especially as a young person, where you talk to them and they're like, oh yeah, that was a movie. You know,
it was a gig I did.
Yeah. So you're putting way too much, you're putting way too much energy into this. Like, chill out. Just go tell a story. And so there was a sort of combination of those elements. Moments. And, you know, I remembered talking to Zemeckis about it and him saying just how loose the process was when Poltergeist was being made, that, you know, they were, him and Bob Gale were in the next room working on the draft that they were trying to get Back to the Future greenlit while Steven was in pre-production on E.T. and in production on Poltergeist. And that it was just like it was a perfect vehicle for cool gags. Like they all approached it like, oh, try this, you know, have the head melt off, or
have the clown, have the clown with the arms. It'll be fine.
Exactly. So obviously incredible artistry, very, very difficult to enter into that world and connect to people to whom that film was so important. But I had a great time making it. So proud of my cast.
Mm-hmm. Amazing cast.
Yeah. I'll end as I began. I got a call from Sam Raimi.
if Sam Raimi called me up like, hey man, can you redo Evil Dead for me? I'd be like, I mean, you're asking me, so I guess yes. If that's
whatever you say, Sam Raimi.
Like, exactly. Now, did you pull any nuggets of wisdom from Sam working with him on that?
Oh yeah, he's so cool. First of all, there's no better audience in the world than Sam Raimi. He watches every single screening of every film, whether he worked on it or not, as if it was a matinee in a movie theater. When he's 10 years old, he sits front and center with a huge grin on his face, soaking up the story. And I got mostly from him the notion that you can work in this career, in this industry, for as long as he has, with as much success as he has, and still find the absolute joy in film viewing as much as film making. And so that just like put so much wind in my sails. It's inspiring when you're working with collaborators who are just so passionate about the craft of storytelling.
I've had the pleasure of meeting some of these folks as well, and it's, they're just like on a whole other level. Like the way that they approach the craft is just at a completely different depth than the civilians or normal
totally.
Or yeah,
totally.
it's just remarkable to see them approach story. And I love that you said to like, yeah, it was a story. Yeah, it was a little gig. Yeah, we were just throwing some gags up there, see what would work. Because that's what we do when you're starting out. Like, that's exactly what we do with our friends. It just so happens that their friends who happen to be like, you know, John Milius and Brian De Palma and George Lucas. Yeah. So
it was they just happened to be hanging out with a high wattage crowd.
That's great term. Great term. I love that term. It's pretty awesome. Now, so your latest project you worked on, was your second to latest project. You have two projects that are coming out pretty close together, but we're here to talk about Ghostbusters. And oh my God, I saw it last night. It is, there's no spoilers here, so you can continue listening, everybody. There is no spoilers. I won't spoil anything. All I got to say is it is the sequel that Ghostbusters deserved. In my humble opinion,
that's very kind of you to say. I'm so proud of it.
For people listening, Ghostbusters for me was one of those films I literally saw probably I'm not an exaggeration, probably 35 times in the theater. Like it was a goal of mine to keep going back every weekend, and every time I got re-released, because there was re-releases back then, I wore out the cassette tape.
You know what's crazy is,
God, man,
checking to see how long that film played in cinemas or
in theaters.
It came out in June of 84 and was still in movie theaters all the way through like fall. I think by November it was starting to leave movie theaters. But it's just an incredible concept when you think about it. And I think it stayed number one in September.
Oh, yeah. October. It was a phenomenon, and I was living in New York, and my Ghostbuster stories is this. My stepfather was the taxi cab driver. So we're driving around Manhattan, and I was with him in the front seat, and all of a sudden I drive by the Ghostbusters set when nobody was there. It was just blocked off, and it was like after Gozer did all the thing, and the ambulance is inside, and there's snow, because I didn't know it was marshmallow, snow everywhere. And then 6 months later, I go to the theater. I'm like, oh my God, I was on the set of Ghostbusters. It was my first.
That is so cool.
It was my first true experience of being even close to Hollywood, being close to a real movie. That was the first time I ever even understood what a movie set was. Because for kids listening today, there was no information in the 80s about filmmaking. None. None.
No, I learned most of what I know about movie making from the Universal Studios tour when we went as tourists. Like, I think that's where I learned about the ideas behind what went into making something.
Right.
So it's so cool that you got to experience that set probably the morning after they filmed it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard Jason talk about this, but Jason Reitman, my collaborator, co-writer, and the director of Ghostbusters Afterlife, was on set that day at that, on the west side of Central Park,
where
you saw the road opened up. And he was actually filmed with his mom and I think his sister as part of the background of the folks watching the Ghostbusters doing their thing, and was cut out of the film. But he remembers, it's one of his first memories as a kid, was watching them pouring that marshmallow fluff out of buckets on risers. And feeling like, all right, this is movie making.
This is what I want to do. I want to do this.
This is what I want to do. Yeah. So you guys happen to be in the same place in the same moment of time, which is really cool.
That's actually really it's that's funny as hell, man. And so Ghostbusters has a very special place in my heart for both Ghostbusters 1 and Ghostbusters 2. And I was in New York when that hit. So you could only imagine. It was a phenomenon around the world. But being in New York, as a kid, when Ghostbuster hit, it was everything. It was like, there was nothing else. Like, I don't know what the Indiana Jones had just come out. Maybe like there wasn't as much stuff as there is today. There's a million things to watch. It was like Ghostbusters was it, man. And the music, that song, oh, Jesus Christ, it's
so good. So it was a pretty crazy summer because I think Goonies came out.
Yeah.
Like, no, sorry.
Gremlins
later. I meant Gremlins.
Yeah. Gremlins
came out. The other G titled Gremlin film. Gremlins came out that same summer, and so obviously that was like a life changing summer for those of us who were lucky to go to movies 85. At that time. And for me, it was a pretty crazy experience with it, because we moved to America when I was 7 in July, almost August of 1984. And Ghostbusters was the first film that I saw in a movie theater when we moved to America. Obviously, I'd seen films before that, but I so associated it with this country that I was now living in, with what a Hollywood movie was and could be. And just like you, it became culture. It became more than a film.
Oh, yeah.
It was something that we grew up with.
I actually called the 555 number trying to get to the Ghostbusters.
Was it just busy?
No, it's a 555 number, so nothing happened. Yeah. I think it was busy or something like that. But I actually watched it, a commercial one by. I'm like, I wrote down the number real quick. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna call the Ghostbusters.
That's so sweet. And, you know, by the way, we all felt that instinct. That's why there are moments in this film.
Right. So I want to get
you saw last night. That are about satisfying the experience that we had as young people watching Ghostbusters, because that was our mandate, was like how to capture the awe and the joy and the weirdness and magic of seeing Ghostbusters in 1984 in today's world.
The Ghostbusters universe is something that I feel that needs to be respected, and you guys definitely did it in a way that the Star Wars universe or the Star Trek universe or any other sci-fi universe, because it has its own world. And it, and that world can be built out beautifully. And I think you guys, I think, the thing I loved about the film, man, is that you guys got the tone so perfectly done, because you can tell that you were definitely nodding to the fanboys in the room, you know, and then you were also helping the kids of the fanboys in the room as well. So how did you as writers balance nostalgia with bringing this concept into the new generation?
Well, I think that one of the ways we did it was by being aware of what our own expectations were for a new Ghostbusters film
right.
as fans. I mean,
right.
obviously, look, Jason and I come at this from similar but extraordinarily different places. So like both of us grew up with a love and a
sure.
passion and respect for Ghostbusters. But I was a kid watching it in a movie theater in the Valley.
It's his dad.
Jason was the son of a director on the side of the camera. Went on the press tour with Ivan when the film was being released. And so for him, it was an incredibly intimate relationship. And for me, it was just like a fanboy one.
Right.
But both of us approached the idea of telling another Ghostbusters story with incredible respect for the films of the 1980s. And we had a sense of as fans of what we would want to see, but we also knew that if we just made this a sort of museum tour of the past, it would end up feeling like a pretty stiff
right.
and lifeless spectacle. And it happened that through the work of building the character of Phoebe and her family, her brother Trevor, her mom Callie, her friends, podcasts, and Lucky, that we got to a place where we realized that actually just as important as our own satisfaction of seeing things that we would want to see in a Ghostbusters film, we have the opportunity to have pure discovery in this film, because we have characters who have no fucking clue what a Ghostbuster was. And they've grown up in a world where, just like a lot of events from
the 80s
prehistory, yeah, this is stuff that doesn't really register in the lives of many people. And so, and there's a specific reason for why this particular family, Phoebe's family, has kept sort of blinders to the events of those years.
Right.
Much more, you know, much more sort of emotional and baggage related rationale. But the point is that through the character of Phoebe, through her eyes, we're able to discover Ghostbusters for the first time all over again, if you know what I mean.
No,
and
that became
our compass. That was our way through.
It's so funny because my daughters, they say old timey when it comes to anything that was pre when they were born. They're like, so when was that, like the 80s? Sometimes they'll bust out like the 30s. I'm like, how old do you think I am? Like you know, when Titanic came, like, were you around when Titanic sank? I'm like, no, I'm not around. What? How old do you think I am? But
were you freaked out when that train came at you in the movie theater?
I was.
And it felt like it was
jumping. I jumped right on my horse and buggy and I just bolted out of that theater. But it's fascinating because I love the way that you bring back the 80s in a way, bring back those events in a way that this generation understands, you know, with the way they view things and things like that. So it was masterfully done. And I applaud both you and Jason to do it. When I heard about it, I was like, okay, if there's anybody that can do this, it's Jason. As a director, yeah. I just felt it. I was like, okay, because I respect him as a filmmaker tremendously, and that he's tackling this thing is remarkable. Now,
well, to that point, I mean, one of the things that made this whole thing meaningful and actually gave it a sort of shape is that as much as this is a film about characters discovering their legacy as Ghostbusters, It's also a film about a director who is tackling his legacy as a filmmaker. And
right.
that because that works on multiple levels, it felt like there was always a way in. Like, we always understood that this was a film that had had something to say. It was about the weight of familial responsibility and whether you choose to turn around and face it or try to chart your own path or you know, run away from it, basically. So we sort of knew that that was in the background.
And I heard Jason came up right prior to the screening on a little pre-recorded video, and he's like, this is the most personal film I've ever made. And I understand why, because you're right, the characters are mirrors. Like, the director and the characters in the movie are mirrors. They're both dealing with legacy. Mm. And approaching it, and should you do it? And I have to imagine you and Jason must have had conversations, is like, should I go down this road? Because, I mean, you know, the amount of, I mean, look, fans are fans, and haterade, and all that's going to come out. But at a certain point, it's like, I mean, do I want to step foot in this hollowed, like, this is hollowed, you talk about hollowed ground. Ghostbusters
It's so loaded, but also I think that we approached it without an expectation that this was something that had to get made. We started talking about it as friends and collaborators, and Jason had these couple of images that had sort of been haunting him, right? A girl discovering a proton pack, a teenager who finds what was the Ecto-1, but now sort of a rusted over heap. And all of that was kind of swirling in his head while he was thinking about the loss of Harold Ramis and how you really can't have a Ghostbusters story, or at least continue the story of the original Ghostbusters, without Harold Ramis.
And of course.
So there was just this idea that started to come together about a way to thread that concept with the images that I was just explaining. And when Jason and I started talking about it, we never said, let's make sure this happens because we've got to make a Ghostbusters film, or because Jason has to direct one. It was like, there is actual genuine enthusiasm, because we started to feel like a true way to make a sequel to Ghostbusters was beginning to form in our eyes. And that we started to work this out without a studio, without any interference, just the two of us as friends. And then we realized that it just kept coming together. And before we knew it, we had a story. And we brought that story to Ivan and pitched it to him. And that was obviously a really important moment in the life of this film. And then we brought it to some of the other Ghostbusters, and we brought it to Sony, and they were just so supportive and so understanding of what this could be. And it really felt like, okay, this has a chance to be a true continuum. It's not something that was handed to us as an assignment, like find a way to make a new Ghostbusters film. It was done in about as pure of a way as could be imagined.
I mean, you were basically writing it as almost like fan art. Like,
really. I mean, we really were. I mean, the only complication is that Jason had a front row seat to the entire building of the Empire.
Right.
But it really was done with absolute sort of removed from the expectations of the business or the fans. It was done as two lovers of Ghostbusters who were seeing if we could build a story that would live up to this world.
And from what I understand from Jason's video intro to the screening, Papa Reitman, Mr. Ivan Reitman, was on set every day with his director's chair right next to Jason. So what was it like, you know, having that presence over you? It's having Toby Hooper on the set of Poltergeist every day sitting next to you.
I think the way Jason describes it is like, could you imagine if your dad was sitting next to you at work every day, like,
and questioning everything you do?
Yeah. Oh, you're gonna push that button? Okay. I mean, that's fine. That's the way to do it.
I wouldn't do it that way.
Yeah. It's fine. There's lots of ways to do it, you know. And so you just have to put yourself in the position of Jason to have made a film that works as well as it does.
That's amazing.
But the truth is, yeah. And I've seen this now countless times on this process, that Ivan is extraordinarily proud of his son and has so much love, both for his son as a human, but also for his son as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, and just had like incredible respect. They have a lot of mutual respect, those two, and being close to them over these years has just given me a lot of appreciation for the relationship that they have.
Now, let's talk a little bit real quickly about A Boy Called Christmas. How did you come up with that idea? How the hell did you get it made in this with a budget in today's insane world?
So I can't wait for you to see it. It'll be out in the States on Netflix the day before Thanksgiving, so really soon, like next Wednesday. It's based on a novel by Matt Haig, who this year I think is the number one selling author in the world for his novel Midnight Library, which has been changing lives all over the world. And he wrote this book with a really simple question. His son asked him one night before Christmas, what was Santa Claus like when he was my age? And the question just kicked off a bedtime story that very quickly became a novel. And the book is so full of life. It felt to me when I read it like this was the obvious next step in the storytelling mode of Roald Dahl. You know, like this is a way to approach a young character's adventure where you're not holding back from all the horrible things that kids have to go through. It's got monsters, it's got real magic, it's got incredible scope, because I went to Lapland start filming this film. So I went up to the Arctic Circle. Then we went up
You filmed up at the Arctic Circle?
Yeah, we filmed in the Arctic Circle. It was the coldest, man. I have never been so cold in my life. I got off the plane and I felt my breath freezing in my mouth. It was the craziest feeling. And I survived barely by having Bluetooth controlled electric socks that I was able to like.
Bluetooth? That's amazing.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't be saying that even out loud because I realize it's embarrassing.
Listen, I've been cold. I understand what that means. Whatever it takes to stay warm, I don't care if it's Bluetooth. I don't care if it's a fire log in your socks. Whatever, man. You do it.
The gear. But we had a scene, one of the first scenes of drama in this film. We had taken all the camera equipment up to a frozen lake at the top of the High Tatras Mountains in Slovakia, using snowmobiles. It was the only way we could get the equipment up there. And then filmed on a frozen lake using a mobile camera rig that the Grips invented for this film, because we shot 70mm. And they built a camera rig using basically a series of metal poles with a gyro-controlled head slung from them, just so that we can have really smooth, precise moving camera work on a frozen lake in the mountains while a snowstorm was coming down. And that was the first proper scene that we shot with all the actors. It was an incredible adventure. I'm very proud of the film. It filmed like all over Europe. We ended up filming in London and the Czech Republic and Prague, where a lot of the sets were built, in Slovakia and in Finland, as I mentioned. And it was a labor of love.
Adventure.
The cast is insane. Maggie Smith, Toby Jones, Sally Hawkins,
Kristen Wiig,
Kristen Wiig, Stephen Merchant. Yeah, I'm psyched for you to see it.
I can't wait to see it.
Hopefully, as somebody who dug City of Ember, I think this one's going to be right up your alley.
Yeah, it's remarkable that you were able to get this made, man. And in the 70 mil, and it's like you're a unicorn, essentially, with film like this. I mean, seriously, like, you know how it works in the business, man. They don't make movies like this, let alone 70 mil, let alone I'm going to fly. Like, that's a James Bond movie. Like that's a, like, you know, and I know you didn't have James Bond money.
Nope.
You
no.
know,
no, it's all on the screen and then some. I mean, basically, you know, you'll see that we really got, we got a lot of story up there, and,
can't wait to see it.
It's cool. Yeah. I'm psyched for you to see it.
Now I'm going to ask you three questions. I ask all of my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
To tell stories in whatever way you can. And that doesn't always mean film or script. It can be a tiny picture book. It could be a Christmas card. It could be a craftily worded letter. But I think that actually storytelling is the exercise that makes you a filmmaker, not directing or camera work or the technical aspects to the job, but the pure act of storytelling. So I would just say nothing can stop you. Keep telling stories.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
I think saying no is a really powerful tool that somebody who grew up like me, you know, in a part of the city with no real access or opportunity. The idea that at some point you need to be able to say no to things because you have only so many films or so many stories or so many years or days in your life that you get to do. And it's not a natural one, but I think it's an important one, because if you say no to something, then what it immediately asks or suggests to you is that you have to have the thing that you say yes to. And I've found now in my recent experience that when you say no, somehow a light shines on the thing that you should be doing
at
the same time. And so that's something I've learned.
Great, great piece of advice. Three of your favorite films of all time.
So Clockwork Orange, because I remember and it's not because of all the
Kubrick memorabilia
around you, but it's because it was a moment of pure, pure cinema for me.
How in the God's green earth did he get that made in the 70s? That movie couldn't get made today. The first 20 minutes, just the first 20 minutes of that film. How could that even get made? It's a masterwork.
It's a miracle. All right, I'm going to get pretentious with the next one, but it's because I mean it, because it was a movie that actually changed my life when I was young. My dad took me to see this film when I was way too young. It was The Tin Drum. I don't know if you've seen it. A German film.
I remember.
It's incredible and so messed up, but totally changed my life. Okay. So there you go. And another film that I'm going to bring up because it changed my life, because I remember that when it ended, I thought to myself, somebody made that film. There's a person, there's a madman behind this story, and I want to be that person one day. And that film was Time Panic.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, yeah.
And yeah. when it ended, I just remember feeling like a rush that this was a story that was made by people, and how lucky they were. And I would do anything in my powers to get to be in that chair one day.
Terry Gilliam, I mean, one of the most I feel one of the most underappreciated filmmakers of his generation. It's just, he's so I remember seeing Time Bandits in the theater when I was a kid, and it blew my head wide open. I was like, how is this even? But even then, I still didn't believe. I didn't even think. It was like being a filmmaker was not even a conception in the mid 80s. Really, it just really was so. It was so another world.
It was a closed world. I mean, it wasn't something. Again, I every time I step on a set, I still get that rush. They're like, that I'm,
I can't believe I'm doing this.
They're letting me do this. Totally agree. I got to meet Terry Gilliam right before I filmed City of Ember. We had dinner together in London.
Oh my god,
so cool. He was amazing. He weirdly, you know, grew up in Reseda just like me, so we had a lot of. We had a lot of stuff to talk about, but it's cool.
And last question, three screenplays that you think every screenwriter should read.
Well, I've recently read the, I recently read the screenplay to Chinatown, and I thought I would just be reading it for a couple of pages because I had found it somewhere, and I started reading it, and I was like, holy shit, this is so good. And I just could not reading it. Three screenplays. If you haven't read a Sorkin screenplay on the page, I really recommend it because the way that the words form and the Social Network screenplay is so good. So great on the page. And I guess in a slightly different way, I feel like reading a Diablo Cody script is like a total bit of joy for the brain. Like I've had the good fortune of reading a couple of her screenplays on paper, and she just has such an amazing way with words and character. And obviously my friend Jason Reitman's been lucky enough to bring a few of them to life on the screen. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that sort of come to mind right off the bat. I'm sure I'll think of 20 more
tonight. But Gil, man, thank you so much for coming on the show, bro. It has been an absolute honor and pleasure talking to a fellow film geek about geeking out about Ghostbusters and all the other stuff that we discussed. So thank you again. Tell Jason, thank you for making Ghostbusters Afterlife, because it is... I can sleep at night now because it was rough for me since 89. I just like, when is this going to happen? I can sleep now. So thank you, my friend.
Hearing that you can sleep means that I can finally sleep, and I'll call Jason up. He'll appreciate it too. Thank you. This has been a real blast. Thank you for taking the time to really talk through the films that I've been lucky enough to be a part of.
I want to thank Gil so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe. Thank you again so much, Gil, not for only coming on the show, but for helping bring Ghostbusters to a new generation. As many of you heard in the interview, I am a huge, huge Ghostbusters fan. And if you have not seen me dressed as a fifth grader in my ghetto Ghostbusters outfit that my mom made for me, you definitely got to check that out. I don't know if I'll put it in the show notes, but it will definitely be on our Facebook feed. So thank you again so much for listening, guys. Oh, and by the way, we will be having our yearly Black Friday blowout sale at IFH Academy, which we will be giving 30% off every single course in the IFH Academy library. So if you want to learn about distribution, if you want to learn about producing from a seasoned veteran producer, do you want to learn how to develop your characters more emotionally from James Hart, the writer of Hook and Dracula, if you want to learn how to finance your movie, if you want to learn how to attach movie stars to your script or project, all of these courses and webinars are available at ifhacademy.com, and all you need to do is use the coupon code BLACKFRIDAY2021. That's BLACKFRIDAY2021, and that will be the code for the deal. So definitely check that out. It will be going on until the end of the month, but after that, it is gone. So act now. Thanks again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.